Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Francine Prose. Her new novel is Blue Angel. It's published by HarperCollins. She's the author as well, and you've heard her on Bookworm about her book Guided Tours of Hell. But from the beginning, Judah the Pious, The Glorious Ones, Marie Laveau, up until the very most recent Blue Angel. One of them was turned into a movie, Household Saints. One of them enthralled me and put me to bed happy, Animal Magnetism. Several of them are still in paperback. It's a very various career, and there are two distinct kinds of novels that she's written. Early on, she wrote books that involved essentially parables, fairy tales, about figures of power. An Old Testament prophet, a voodoo queen. They were extraordinary and lovely, very much influenced by the spirit of the 60s. And now these sourer books, and funnier, have begun to appear. Blue Angel is a marriage, it seems to me, of two kinds of books. A satirical novel on the one hand, and a novel, a psychological novel, a novel of penetration of character. And I wanted to begin by asking you, because it seems to me that these two forms are always at war with one another. Satire requires radical simplification to create a world in which everything can be laughed at. Psychological penetration involves saying, yes, this too is human. This too can be accepted. Yes, it falls within the province of the possible, of the possibly human. So it seems like a very hard book to write.
Well, actually, I was more interested in writing a psychological novel than I was in writing a satirical novel. And as grateful as I am for the reviews that have been coming out, I'm always surprised when people refer to the book as an academic satire, since the two kinds of novels that I'm essentially not particularly interested in reading are academic novels and satirical novels. So it was sort of a shock to me to find out that I'd written the book that I had the least, the sort of book that I had the least interest in. I mean, it occurred to me, actually, just the second, as you were asking, the way it gets divided up, in fact, in the novel, is that the main characters, I think, are characters in a psychological novel. That is Swenson, his wife, Angela, to a certain extent. And the very minor characters, the walk-on characters, are characters in a satirical novel because they're done broadly. They're done much more broadly. They're much more emblematic the way characters are in a satirical novel. But in a way, I only wanted kind of broad strokes for them. I only needed broad strokes for them, and I wanted much more delicate and nuanced renderings of the main characters.
Well, I think in particular, though, the scene of the action, a creative writing class, at a time when a creative writing class will of necessity be a place, one hopes, where the writer's deepest perceptions and privatest truths are handled and dealt with on the one hand. On the other hand, an academic situation which requires that a teacher, no matter what, is not intimate with his students.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teacher of the creative writing class spends most of his time trying to sidestep statements.
Do a big end run around.
Yes. It does seem like a naturally comic and satiric circumstance. And since most people think that creative writing can't be taught to begin with, it involves the classic subject of satire, charlatanry.
Right, yeah. Right. Charlatanry, and also the other classic subject of satire, which is sadism.
Uh-huh.
And that's the thing that people never ask, or maybe know enough never to ask. I mean, that is, people say, you know, can creative writing be taught, and is a classroom the venue in which to try and teach this, or can it be done? But no one ever seems to ask, including people who've been in these classes and taught these classes, who dreamed up such an incredibly cruel method of teaching writing, you know, as to get a bunch of strangers together and have them dissect the work of the most helpless member, you know, the member who is forced to be silent for the entire, you know, it's like sort of interrogation techniques or you know, I often think after I've taught a class of those groups in the Chinese Cultural Revolution, you know, where groups of the neighbors would get together and just brutalize one of the members of the group. And at the end, the brutalized person would say, oh, thank you so much. I feel like I'm such a better comrade than I was at the beginning of the session. Well, that is the sort of thing that goes on in the creative writing classroom.
Now, you yourself have taught creative writing.
Yes, I confess. And still do.
That's why I think that the book can't, in a sense, be a satire, because why would you satirize something that you continue to do? A true writer of satire would have to, you know, swear a vow of abandonment.
Right.
Now that I've seen it, falsehood, I must no longer, because a satirist is also a moralist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, part of why it's not a satire, I guess, and why I feel in so many ways identified with my problematic hero is that all the things that he experiences teaching are things I've experienced, particularly the way in which he himself over-identifies with the student whose work is being discussed. I mean, one of the reasons I find it so hard to teach that kind of class is not just the experience of reading work that may not be first rate and watching students who may not know what they're talk about this work, so much as saying, you know, how would I feel if I were that student and were listening to these people talk about my work in that way? I'd be running from the room in tears.
Well, not only that, it seems to me you started publishing novels at the age of 20, mm-hmm. therefore started writing them well before that. And at 20, the first was quite accomplished and quite admired, Judah the Pious, the Old Testament prophet one. And so it would seem to me that you would have a deeper background in what it's like to be young, mm-hmm. and forced into the peculiar limelight that gets built around a writer when she begins early on.
Right. Yeah, I'm an autodidact, Michael. I mean, I don't have an MFA, and I didn't go through that system. And I don't know how my work would have developed if I had gone through that system. You know, I was writing. I mean, I just didn't know that that's what you did. And I feel very grateful now for having had the kind of freedom to make mistakes and make things up and do things that weren't conventional without my peers looking over my shoulder and saying, you know, I want more of this and the story should have more of this. I mean, that sort of consensus writing.
Well, I want to suggest what I see in these books, because I really was trying to figure out how... You've answered me before about the change in the kind mm-hmm. of novel you write, but I still try to imagine that change psychologically. And it occurred to me as I was reading Blue Angel by my guest Francine Prose that ambivalence is really deeply at the center of your work. And that, you see, reading the first 20 pages... I thought I was going to be reading the kind of novel where the man talks about how much he loves his wife, as we see by his behavior that, in fact, he doesn't love her, she doesn't love him. He wakes up alone on the couch, and he doesn't quite know how he got there. So all the earmarks are there for the narrator of false consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, in fact, what turns out is that sometimes they love each other very much, they have quite a history together, and sometimes they're a couple on the verge of falling apart. Either could happen, and both are true, and they're happening in parallel. This seems to me the kind of psychological penetration of the book, that lives are conducted by contraries.
Mm-hmm.
The contradiction is the nature of consciousness.
Don't you think ambivalence is the human condition?
Oh.
I mean, you know, and it's moment by moment. I mean, I don't think that you get an hour without it. I mean, just on the way over here, we stopped and had lunch and had this perfectly lovely lunch. And and looking at the menu and saying, gee, maybe I should have ordered this instead of this perfectly wonderful thing that I have. Well, you know, that's just sort of low-level, moment-by-moment ambivalence. I mean, the thing, you're right, I'm always writing about ambivalence, and the thing that's actually been gratifying to me is that it seems that, I don't know what, the reader or the critic or something is more able to tolerate that sort of ambivalence. Because one of the things about Household Saints that I was really working towards is, you know, the kind of basic ambivalence is, was the girl in the novel a saint or was she not? A fairly essential question. I didn't want to resolve it, and I didn't see why it should be resolved. Well, in Blue Angel, is Swenson a good guy or is he not such a good guy? Well, the answer is he's just a human guy in the way that all humans are, and ambivalent in the way I think we all are.
And as well, the young woman, because he discovers in this class a student, Angela Argo, whose work he thinks is very interesting, and at least the first sample of it that he sees is interesting. The second sample is not so interesting, and he's projecting onto it, you know, because he wants to have a star pupil.
He wants it to be interesting.
Yeah, very badly.
And, yeah, and also, speaking of ambivalence, he really can't tell the difference between his interest in her and his interest in the work, and his interest in screwing up his own life. So, so all those, you know, three kinds of parallel, contradictory things are happening at once.
At once. And she is a psychological casualty, and yet at the same time, she's very manipulative. In fact, perhaps because she's a psychological casualty. And so sometimes it seems as if the professor is taking advantage of her. In the long run, it becomes that she is taking advantage of the professor. And in addition, several accidents occur as well, so that she wins several hands without having had to play them.
Right. And also, who knows, maybe she's an artist. I mean, you know, the thing is that her novel that she's writing in the course of the novel, it's not very good, but it's not bad for a 22-year-old.
That's exactly
right?
True.
And she thinks of herself as an artist, and she sees herself, unlike all the other students in the class and unlike most college students that one runs into, in the tradition of Charlotte Bronte and Stendhal and so forth. So she certainly sees herself as an artist. So maybe that kind of, you know, omnivorous, carnivorous part of her nature is part of being an artist. Who knows?
And it seems, though, in a peculiar way, because she succeeds in her manipulations in life, it's likely that she'll fail at her manipulations in art. I thought the winning she probably lost. That
Do
was
you
my
think that's true?
Often.
Really?
Because, you see, if you succeed on the stage of the world, you no longer have to succeed on the page. Often it seems to me that the brilliance that goes into marking a novel is the result of a deep knowledge of disappointment and complicated failure, and that once you manage to become a scintillating savage in the world, why go home to your notebook?
Right,
I mean, you
right.
do well enough, you know, at parties.
Gosh, I want to have that stitched on a sampler and put over my desk. I guess it's a little long for the sampler, but if we can somehow condense it.
Now, it occurred to me that this woman, Angela, is in many ways an ex figure. Everyone has an impression of her. Her former poetry teacher is embarrassed by the poems that came out of an experience of phone sex. She had worked as a sex worker.
Right, a sex worker. Right.
Yeah. and she turned these things into sort of Plath-like poems involving a lot of ritual repetition and screams in the night.
Those were so much fun to write bad, dirty poems by a student. Writing those. Those were the sort of days you thought, I really like being a writer. It was just fun to go to my desk and do that.
Uh-huh. So the poem, she's been regarded, she also is the focus of a lot of speculation by a librarian to whom She's brought the book, insisting that it be put in the school library by her former poetry teacher, by her new teacher, Ted Swenson, the hero of this book. And so we get the sense that the way in which a novel is built is by ambivalence, by creating so much meaning around a person or an object that it becomes resonant.
Well, I mean, there are two things about that. One is just a technical thing. That is, it's not an omniscient novel. It's pretending to be an omniscient novel, but it's very much not one. I mean, it's really from Swenson's point of view, and he has no more idea about who Angela is than anyone else in the novel. So, yes, it's absolutely true. They're projecting all over her, and they have these ideas, and, you know, there is that ambivalence. On the other hand, what we know about her is really finally what we know about anybody, which is just the facts of her behavior, what she's done and what she hasn't done. And one of the things that was fun about writing it was that the facts, such as they were, weren't adding up correctly for the other characters because they didn't know or didn't want to or weren't able to add them up. I mean, for example, once Swenson found out that she had insisted that this book of her poetry be shelved in the library, it should have been, as they say, a red flag. I mean, there are many things like that. And he just, because of his desire not to see these things or not to think about these things, he never gets it until it's way too late.
By the way, I'm talking to Francine Prose about her novel Blue Angel, published by HarperCollins. It occurred to me, what if the young woman in the classroom were Francine Prose, coming in with novels about voodoo queens and and Renaissance theater troupes and Old Testament prophets, would you be capable of making yourself into that kind of figure of ambivalence, resonance, and almost pathetic fawn?
Well, full disclosure time. My first novel started in a creative writing classroom. I was a graduate student at Harvard. I was in the process of flunking out of graduate school, basically, but I was sticking around and I was taking this one writing class. And I had a very different experience from Angela's. That is, I was reading chapters of Judith the Pious aloud, and what happened was, and that was the sense in which it was really good for me. What happened was my fellow students and the professor, Monroe Engel, who was teaching it, were interested in this. I mean, the story was written serially. It was written as if it were a Dickens novel in a certain way. I mean, that is and it had sort of conventional cliffhanger endings to the chapters. I mean, my only interest at that point was to keep the reader interested. So I had the experience of students and I think a teacher who were used to being bored a certain percentage of the time, being interested in what I was doing. And that actually was a useful lesson. That is, you know, your basic primary job is to keep the reader interested. Unfortunately, I think that that's a lesson that's gone out of the writing classroom, that somehow, you know, and in a way, the way the writing classroom is structured militates against that, because as I just told a class, I was in Iowa and I taught a guest workshop. The students have to finish each other's stories. They go into class, they have to be prepared to discuss them. So they have to read them from beginning to end, and they have to know them fairly well. In the real world, you don't have to finish anything. Nothing's making you finish it. So the students lose the sense of having to give the reader a reason to finish what they're doing.
Now, that is a concept that mostly went out of fashion in those days in the late 60s when writers would say, I think that plot, character, and story are the enemies of fiction. But what continues to litigate against it now?
I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know.
It's sort of the most shocking thing, and it's the most alienating thing, when you realize that something that you think is really boring, other people think is interesting or can get interested in. I mean, that's sort of the most upsetting sort of chasm of taste to look across to the other side.
Well, one of the things that I do notice, in fact, is now that there's a kind of resurgence of the Barth, Pynchon, Coover kind of novel. The things that the young writers are bringing to it, what David Foster Wallace said to me was, my job in Infinite Jest was to figure out how to keep a reader on the edge through the duration of a long, hard book. How do I make the pages keep turning? And that, it seems to me, is true with The House of Leaves as well, that they are bringing in all sorts of devices to keep the reader hungry to read, whereas it's the minimalists who are continuing to write that story in which nothing happens.
Nothing happens and nobody cares. But, you know, maybe the answer is that it was never plot and character that did it. I mean, for example, if you read Malloy, you know, what exactly is the plot and who exactly is that character? But there's some, the intensity of language.
The energy of language, the comedy of language, the way in which language filters in and out of consciousness so that it seems to both describe and be consciousness simultaneously.
Or Lydia Davis's work, which seems like, you know, I read those as if we're reading a thriller.
Yes.
You know, and not that much, I suppose, happens, but...
Maybe you're right. That reminds me, it's sort of like situating yourself slightly below the material as if you're peeping up at it like a mouse looking at a slab of cheese on the shelf. There's a great hunger to register the minutiae of desire. And as long as there is somehow yearning and importance being placed, the idea that accuracy will lead to attainment or something.
Certainly. But also, just on the lowest level, to internalize the horror of boring the reader. You know, I mean, and if that's what David Foster Wallace is doing, that's exactly what he should be doing. You know, I mean, the sense that there is someone out there that you want to keep interested. I mean, the books that are really seem boring to me are books in which there doesn't seem to be any sense of that at all.
Now, that is another reason to draw the circle, that this is not a satire, because it seems to me that political correctness is so easy to make fun of that within a few pages, certainly a chapter or two, we'd have come to the end of possibility and boredom would have set in. What's fascinating to me is that the novel begins with some of that crystallinity. It's very well marked. The leading character, Swenson, is introduced in the first chapter, his wife in the second, the device of the promising student. It's a very carefully controlled kind of book that then splays, and all sorts of possibilities and ambiguities open up. And for me, it was the ambiguities that gained my interest more than the directness of presentation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that I'm not interested in reading satirical novels is that the characters aren't interesting, but because they're not complex. They're meant to produce one effect, and the effect is, you know, you're standing outside the character, you're laughing at the character represents something rather than is something, and you know, what I was trying to do was to create characters who were as complicated as people, as we recognize human beings are, and in a way more complicated than what we usually recognize. I mean, that is, you know, in Swenson, I wanted him to seem to be one thing and then turn out to be about 30 other things as the novel progressed, all of which were compatible with the one thing he seemed to be.
To me, the most eerie and frightening moment of the novel came a couple of times when, in a bout of helplessness, he begins describing the novel to friends and fellow faculty as his own, as the book he's working on, indicating that these problems of projection, of fractured identity, are almost at the heart of that creative writing process. So the people come out of it less integrated.
I know. He wishes it were his own. And what do they call those things? Boundaries issues? Is that when people say?
Yeah.
But what I also wanted to do in those scenes, and often, you know, there's something in the back of my mind. I mean, That scene in Lady with the Pet Dog where Gurov is trying to talk about Anna and the guy who he's had dinner with in the club says, don't you think the oysters were a little off? Or so, you know, that is, I mean, that desire to tell someone in some fractured, abstracted way about something that's really important to you, and then they just natter on about something else they're doing. Well, I think, you know, when Swenson starts talking about Angela's novel or his novel or whoever's novel he thinks it is, there's something about trying to tell the truth in some way, and it just falls into the void.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, at the end of Blue Angel, which is a faculty confrontation of the by now guilty professor, there are 100 explanations for what he's done and for what he hasn't done. But it doesn't matter. It's the opposite of what is said about Chekhov in the novel, that the richness and density of experience allows for compassion. Here, guilt is determined by a simple mechanism. Did you or didn't you sexually contract with a student? Everything else is irrelevant, and everyone knows it too. So the possibilities of understanding anything at all are being obscured rather than revealed by mm-hmm. justice. And so the book goes back to satire, or the simplicity of satire, but with a very sad set of consequences. As a reader, you want to address the assembled faculty yourself and say, well, wait, you don't understand. He didn't know at that time what he was doing. You don't understand mm-hmm. him. You don't understand her. You don't understand life. You don't understand them. Is the point of the book that people who are exterior to circumstances can never know the inside, the reasons for behavior?
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, yes, certainly that's what happens. Certainly that's what happens. But, you know, that last scene really is precisely what we've been talking about. I mean, that is, you get the confrontation between the character in the psychological novel and the characters in the satirical novel.
Exactly.
Right?
That's so fascinating.
Right? So there you get these, you know, the faculty committee who are all just emblematic in a certain way, the deconstructionist and the feminist critic and so forth. And then you get Swenson. And the fact is that those characters, the satirical characters, are never going to be moved to compassion. I don't think they're really capable of compassion, but in a way, their compassion didn't interest me. The reader's compassion was what interested me. So I think, or I hope, that the reader has a kind of compassion for Swenson that they're not capable of having, and that their incapacity actually makes it easier for the reader to feel compassion for Swenson because you know, the way you're sort of drawn to be on the side of someone whom everyone else is against.
Well, I've been speaking to Francine Prose, the author most recently of Blue Angel, a novel published by HarperCollins. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with book, off the mouse, pop. Ah!